بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Before we proceed to our slides today, there were a couple of questions sent to me by email from one of the brothers. One is about the collection of the Shia Hadith during the time of the Imams, which we discussed last week. And the question is that if all these Hadith were collected, then how the Shia in particular did not appreciate the details about the 12th Imam. Well, the reason is all these books were written secretly and were kept secretly. It was not something well known. Now, today we will go through some traditions which are very clear from Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, from Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam, about the 12th Imam. However, you should not think that these hadith were widespread at the time of the Imams themselves. These were confidential things which were somehow released after a few decades. Not at the time of the Imams. Not immediately when the reporters received them, they were allowed to divulge them to other people. They were very secretly kept. We have many instances of books of many of our greatest scholars who were destroyed because they were kept in a very secret place without anyone having access to them. Like, for example, Ibn Abi Umayr, which is one of the most famous Shia reporters, who, when he was taken to prison by the Abbasid Caliph, he left all his books, which were containing tremendous number of traditions from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. He left them with his sister, and his sister kept them in a water container, in a cellar, where no one had access to. And unfortunately, the rain destroyed all of them. And that's why our scholars say we accept the traditions of Ibn Abi Umayr that he reports to us without chain of transmission, because we know he had the chains, he lost them, because the books were lost. And this is the issue of Marasil Ibn Abi Umayr, the reports of Ibn Abi Umayr, which has no chain. They say we accept them without any chain, because he remembered the traditions, he did not remember the chains of tradition. So it was not a widespread type of thing. Anyone spotted to be a reporter of the Imam, they were captured, they were imprisoned, they were tortured. And even the Imams, you shouldn't think, now we will come to this shortly, you shouldn't think that, for example, all Shia at the time of Imam Zainul Abidin knew that he was the Imam after Imam Hussein alayhi salam. It was a secret kept by very close followers of the Imam. Then you see, for example, here after every 30 years, they release the confidential documents, because there's no need to keep them confidential anymore. And this was absolutely the case with Shia Imams. After several decades, they released the information, the reporters released the information, because there was no danger anymore. But of course, for example, at the time of Imam Hassan al-Askari, they could not release any information about his father or his son. But they could release information about Imam Ja'far al-Sadr, about Imam Zainul al-Abidin. This is how it grew. And therefore, as I said last week, our knowledge about these issues is much more than the knowledge of even many companions of A'imma about these issues. Because these were secretly told to individuals, and they were kept secret. And now there's a pool of resources to which all these traditions have come, and we have a chance to look at them all in one place. The second question is that in the life of the Abbas, why did it take Allama Majlis so long to compile Baha'u'llah al-Anwar? Well, that's a different issue. I mean, even if now we want to compile a book, Allama Majlis was a very talented man. He compiled Baha'u'llah al-Anwar comparatively in a very short time. If you want to compile a book of 110 volumes now, I think it would take a century to do that. So compilation of a book with many different aspects addressed in it is a different issue. If you look into Bahar al-Anwar, it's not just a compilation of traditions. It is the classification is very important, and also it's a full book of theology, a full book of tafsir, because every topic that he has classified and brought the traditions, he has dealt with the ayat, with the tafsir of the ayat, with the theological views of different theologians, and so that should have taken that long. The time frame as to when these scholars were present, okay, what is the time frame of these scholars? I said that the books that we talked about, the 6,600 books, which Shaykh Hurr al-Amali, a contemporary, almost a contemporary of Allama Majlisi, talks about, is the period of A'imma alayhim as-salam. It's from the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen to the time of Imam Hassan al-Askari, these 6,600 books were compiled. And then they were, of course, there were authentic, unauthentic books. 400 of them were unanimously accepted by all scholars to be reliable. And this is what we call al-usul al-arba'a ma'a, the 400 usul, the 400 basic books of Shia, from which Khulaini, Saduq and others compiled their books. So this is how these big compilations came about. Any other question in this regard? Okay, we can proceed forward. Now, as we said, the birth of Imam Hassan al-Askari was a secret birth. And that is why there has been lots of discussions, especially later on, when Western scholars tried to analyze this, and this analysis was taken by some Muslim and Shia scholars as well, through a sort of historical analysis of the development of ideas and thoughts. They said, okay, this secret birth is something which we cannot be sure about, so maybe the Shias developed this idea of the 12th Imam and the birth of the 12th Imam later on in the history, because they lost their Imam, there was no one to lead them, so they had to make something, the idea of occultation and all these things. However, well, we can accept this from a non-Muslim scholar, because they want to analyze this historically, while they believe that whatever the Shias and Muslims believe are wrong. But we cannot accept this from a sort of Muslim, Shia Muslim scholar who is actually well versed in all these historical facts and traditions and believe in them, to somehow go through the same line of analysis as the Western scholars have gone. So let's see some of the facts here about this secret birth and why there was this secret, the birth was kept secret. Just a few traditions now about the secret birth from the Imams who preceded Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. The traditions I bring here are from Imam Zain al-Abidin. Particularly I've chosen these traditions because there is a significance in traditions from Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. And the significance is that after the martyrdom of Hussein alayhi salam, the Shias were devastated. They thought that that's the end of everything. There is no other way. There is no Imam anymore. Our Imam was killed in that brutal way. Is there a hope? Is there something that we can somehow think would someone who would lead us in our struggle for realizing the truth or not? So The traditions from Northern Lebanon are very, very important. Now, after the martyrdom of Hussein, it is impossible for us to imagine what was the psychological situation of the Shia. And therefore, when Imam bin Laden returned to Medina, it was somehow a lost cause, the Shia thought was a lost cause. Everyone thought that everything is finished. And Imam bin Laden was not revealing that he was the Imam after Imam Hussein. Therefore, we have in traditions that only four people believed in Imama of Imam bin al-Abidin when he returned to Medina. Apart from his Ahlul Bayt, of course, we're not talking about his own Ahlul Bayt. And there were other claims on Imama as well, like the Kaysanis believing in the Imama of Muhammad ibn Hanafiya that we talked about. And then we had an uprising in Iraq by Tawabun, and after that by the followers, the person who claimed that he was the follower of Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, the Thaqafi, and all these caused people to not, and of course the danger, people going to house of Imam bin al-Abidin after his father was killed in Karbala as a Khariji, as a someone who had taken arm against the government, it was very dangerous. So we have been told that four people, two very well known, of course, Tabi'i, who are from the Fuqaha, Sa'id ibn Jubayr and Sa'id ibn Musayyib, and Yahya ibn Umm Tawil and Abu Khalid al-Kawi. These are the four followers of Imam bin al-Abidin after the demise of his father. Then, of course, other people joined in. These were the main core who kept the Shi'i cause after the Imam Hussein alive in Medina. Now, the tradition is from Sa'id ibn Jubayr, from Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. Now, why Imam Zain al-Abidin should talk about this more than other Imams? Because now people ask him, is there a hope? Is there someone coming to be able to rise against this oppression? Now, of course, the Imam was answering that. Al-Qa'imu minna. So, he talked a lot about Qa'im. Takhfa wiladatuhu ala al-nas, hatta yaqulu lam yulad ba'du. Al-Qa'im will be born secretly, to the extent that the people will say he is not yet born, so that when he advances, he would have no allegiance to anyone. Now, keep the second part aside now. The important thing is that at the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin, of course, we had these traditions even before, even the Prophet had alluded to it, but especially at the time of Imam Zain al-Abidin, there was this idea that the Qa'im will be born secretly. Now, here, of course, he does not mention because of the danger or anything. There is something more, is more substance into this secret birth. He says, so that when he advances, he would have no allegiance to anyone. Now, look at this. This hadith opens a new window towards the understanding of the concept of occultation. I.e., well, this is very deep. He cannot be present and take sides with no one. You cannot imagine that an Imam lives for hundreds of years and he's present and he never takes sides with anyone. He never says this is right, this is wrong. It's not possible. So his birth is kept secret, he himself is hidden, so that when he comes forth, he hasn't taken sides with anyone, he has no allegiance, he has paid no allegiance to anyone, no pledge on him. So on the other hand, he cannot start his duty until the time is right. When time comes, of course, then he mentions what is right, what is wrong. Of course, he is the side. He doesn't take sides with anyone. He is
decide.
Now, a similar hadith is reported from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and other Imam alayhi salam. صاحب هذا الأمر تأمى ولادته على الحالقة. Both these traditions are from Kamal al-Din of Saduq. صاحب هذا الأمر تأمى ولادته على هذا الخالق لألا يكون لأحد في أنقه بيعة إذا خرج. The same thing. The incumbent of this affair, that is the affair of taking rising against oppression, assuming the leadership, his walada would be confused. People cannot know about it, and the reason is because he doesn't want to have bay'ah with anyone. He should be away from all these events which go during the history in future, of course, future history. Now, the other tradition is very interesting. This is from Abu Hamza al-Somali, who, of course, you know, Dua Abu Hamza, which you recite in Shahr Ramadan. It's from this man. Al-Abi Khalid al-Kabuli. Now, this is Abu Khalid al-Kabuli is one of those four, which I mentioned. Now, interestingly, Abu Khalid al-Kabuli was a supporter of Mukhtar al-Thaqafi and a Kaysani when he came to Medina. He came to see who's the Imam. He was Kabuli, from Kabul, so he was from Afghanistan. He traveled from Afghanistan to Hijaz. And of course, later on, he established, settled there, and we are told that Imam Zainul Abidin helped him, assisted him to travel to Kabul to visit his family once, because it was, of course, very expensive. Much more expensive than air tickets, of course, to travel from Medina to Afghanistan at those times. So he was assisted by Imam Zainul Abidin once to go back to Kabul to visit his family. Now, he came as a Kaysani. He didn't know that Imam Hussein alayhi salam had actually willed to one of his sons, because he was a man of very pure soul. Yahya ibn Umm Tamim, the other person, started to talk to him and told him, come and visit Ali ibn Hussein. As I said, it was dangerous at those times to visit Ali ibn Hussein alayhi salam. And he had a name when he was born. During his childhood, his mother used to call him Kankar. Kankar should be an Afghani, I don't know, Ashtu or whatever. I don't know what sort of name is that. So, and no one knew about it. It was just during his childhood, his mother used to call him Kankar. Probably a very nice name for children. And as soon as he entered to Imam bin Laden's house, Imam told him, how are you, Kankar? And he was amazed. Oh, how this man knows my name, Kankar? And then he started to learn more about Imam bin Laden. And of course, this was due to the fact that Imam knew probably that this is a pure souled man. And he would follow the haqq if he finds about it. So he became one of the closest disciples of Imam. And then he asked about these issues of Imamah, secrets of Imamah. And Imam, of course, did not keep any information from this Abu Khalid. Now, Abu Khalid al-Kabuli says, دخلت على سيدي علي بن حسين زين العابدين عليه السلام. I visited Imam Zain al-Abidin عليه السلام. I told him, يا ابن رسول الله أخبرني بالذين فرض الله طاعتهم ومودتهم وأوجب على عباده الاقتداء بهم بعد رسول الله. So, I don't know when this question was posed to Imam Zain al-Abidin by Abu Khalid. It is when probably he still didn't know who was the Imam after Hussein alayhi salam, and probably still had these doubts of the past, that it was probably Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, because it was somehow reasonable to think coming from Imam Hassan to Imam Hussein, then to their brother again, to Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, rather than going to the son. And still, he was not convinced very easily, and we have another report that on one occasion, Imam took him to Hajar al-Aswad, and Hajar al-Aswad started to witness. I don't know whether this tradition is right or not, but it's not something improbable. There are probabilities here about that. So he said that, O son of the Messenger of God, inform me of those whose love and obedience is made a duty by Allah. He said, O Kabuli, it's interesting, Imam calling him by his name, Kabuli, because naturally he should call him Abu Khalid or Kankar, so to speak, but yes, he calls him by his name, Kabuli. The Ulul Amr, those who Allah has made imams for the people and has made their obedience compulsory, are Amirul Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, then my uncle Al-Hasan, then my father Al-Husayn, then the Amr has ended up in us. That means I am the imam after him. Just removing all confusions about Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, then he stops. I told him, my master, we are reported from Amir al-Mu'mineen that the earth will never be void of a hujjah. This is of course a well-known hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, that the earth will not be without a hujjah. Allahumma bala, this is in Nahj al-Balagha as well, إِنَّ الْأَرْضَ لَا تَخْلُو مِنْ حُجَّةٍ مِنْ غَائِمٌ لِلَّهِ بِحُجَّةٍ إِمَّا ظاهرا مشهورا وإما خائفا مقهورا. He said that we are reported from Amir al-Mu'min that the earth will never be void of a hujjah from God over his servants. So who's the hujjah and the Imam after you? Good question, of course. قال ابن محمد. He said, my son Muhammad, that's Imam Baqir, whose name in the passbook is Baqir. It's interesting. Which past books? We do not see in any past book such a name, Baqir or anything. However, as we have in many traditions, all the books of the past prophets revealed to them, including the Torah, Injil, they are with the Imam. They should be. The Imam should be aware of the past revelations, not the version of Bible which is in our hands, certainly, but the true version of Bible revealed to Musa alayhi salam should be with the Imam. The revealed version of Injil should be with the Imam, and all books of the past. And that's why you see Imam Reza alayhi salam, when he comes to these huge sessions of debates and discussions which was arranged by Ma'mun, he brings lots of quotations from Injil, from Torah, from Zabur, and he brings those quotations which of course were accepted and were still there in their books, so that of course the dialogue would make sense. Where did they have the knowledge? Of course, the knowledge of the past books is given to the Prophet and Imam alayhi salam. However, the very written books of the past as well are with the Imam. So here the Imam says, "Ismuhu fi suhuf al-awwalin Baqir," whose name in the past books is Baqir, for he penetrates the kernel of knowledge. Yabqar al-ilma Baqra. Baqir means to pierce, to penetrate. So he penetrates to the very core of knowledge. هو الحجة والإمام بعدي. He is the حجة and Imam after. ومن بعد محمد ابنه جعفر. After Muhammad is his son جعفر. واسمه عند أهل السماء الصادق. And his name with the people of the heavens, with the inhabitants of the heavens, not people, there are no people in the heavens, angels, of course. Inhabitants of the heavens,
is Sadiq. It means that this is something by which he's known to the angels. I told him I said, why is he named the truthful, Sadiq, my master? Why all of you are truthful? Couldn't we say that Imam al-Hadi is a Sadiq? Yes, of course he is Sadiq. Or Amir al-Mu'minin is a Sadiq. So why is he named a Sadiq while others are not? He said, my father reported from his father, from the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that when my friend Ja'far ibn Muhammad ibn Ali ibn al-Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib, that he gives him the full name until Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he is born, name him as Sadiq. So the Prophet told Amir al-Mu'mineen to tell Husayn alayhi salam, to tell Zayn al-Abidin alayhi salam, to tell Al-Baqir alayhi salam, that when this son is born, name him as Sadiq. Why? Because his fifth descendant, whose name is also Ja'far, would claim Imama, lying and daring against God. So he will be Ja'far al-Kazzab. So to differentiate between these Ja'far, Ja'far al-Sadiq and Ja'far al-Kazzab, who fabricates lie against God and claims what he does not deserve. He will be against his father and jealous to his brother, who will intend to reveal the secret of God on the occultation of the end of God, Waliullah. Inda ghaybati Waliullah, this is a secret. His birth is a secret, his occultation is a secret, and this man, vying for the worldly position of Imamah, he thought that this is something that is just like politics, so he goes for it. This man wants to reveal the secret of the Imam. And that's why he's called Ja'far al-Kazzab, because he claims Imamah for himself. It's very interesting. He went to the Wazir, Ja'far al-Kazzab, and he said that I pay you 200 dirham every year, and you recognize me as the Imam of the Shia. He said, it's very funny what you say. We are looking everywhere for these followers. We are ready to pay them lots of money so that they just tell us who is their Imam. And you are telling me, I appoint you as their Imam. Such a funny, silly man you are. You are saying this. But anyhow, I mean, Shaitan always is at the door. ثُمَّ بَكَى عَلِيُّ بْنُ الْحُسَيْنِ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامُ بُكَاءً شَدِيدًا. Then he cried hard and said, Imam Zayn al-Abidin, it is as if I am looking at Ja'far al-Kazzab while he is leading the oppressor of his time to search the affairs of Waliullah, who is hidden under the care of God, and tries to put someone in charge of his father's house out of ignorance for his position. Of course, this story is very long, the way Ja'far treated the family of his brother after his demise, and the way he brought soldiers in, looking everywhere, searching everywhere, and he said, a child is born, we have to look for it, and of course, the child could not be found. We'll talk about it later on. And a strong desire to kill him would he find him? And out of greed to grab the bequest of his brother unrightfully. Of course, he cries both for the Imam who is hidden and for this Ja'far who is one of his descendants, doing all these things out of the drive from Shaitan. فَقَالَ أَبُو خَالِدٍ. Abu Khalid says, فقلت يا ابن رسول الله وإن ذلك لكائن. I said, O son of the Prophet, is this really going to happen? Is such a thing real? He said, yes, by my Lord. This is written in the Sahifa, in which is the mention of the misfortunes that will inflict us after the Prophet. This is Sahifa Fatima, of course, which was given to him. probably, is Sharifa Fatima, in which everything, that's what the Imams always claim, that وَإِنْدَنَا صَحِيفَةُ فَاطِمَةُ, in which there are all events which are going to happen in future. Of course, you might say that this book should be really huge, because of course everything going to happen in the course of history for the descendants of the Prophet, this needs volumes and volumes. However, it might have been something written in a sort of secretive way that only Imams could find out what the meaning of that is. فقال أبو خالد فقلت يا ابن رسول الله ثم يكون ماذا. I said, O son of the Prophet, what will happen after that? He said, then the disappearance of the Waliullah, the 12th of the Awsiya of the Prophet and the Imams after him, will continue. The disappearance will continue until God knows when. Now, why did I mention this long hadith here? It's very interesting because all the details of the story of the birth of the Imam, the secret birth of the Imam, the way things would unfold, what Ja'far al-Kazzab, his uncle, would do to find him and to kill him so that he gains the position of Imamah, all these details are mentioned in this hadith. Now, there are two possibilities here for those who say that these ideas developed as the history of the Shia went forth. One possibility is that the hadith is correct, as is in Kamaluddin and Saduq bring it with a reliable chain. And the other is that to say all these traditions also were made up afterwards, as people like Shahd and Goldwiher say that all the traditions in Islam from the Prophet are made up later on to support some views and ideas. We have to choose between these two. One is to say that these traditions are there, it's not only one tradition, there are tens of traditions coming from the Prophet, from different A'immah. And then we have to say that these reporters who reported these things, which were very respectful, honorable, reliable people, meticulously tried to fabricate all these to support the view. After, of course, that idea of the Imam of the 12th Imam was developed, we have to believe it. So again, it's not something academic. You have to believe it. You just have to say that I do not believe in the idea of 12th Imam, so I have to find some analysis for it. As for example, Shahd or Goldwiher have said, we do not believe in all these rubbish that the Muslims say, so we have to find an explanation for it. And this is our explanation. These were made up later on by the jurists, by the reporters. Okay. They are right, because they are Muslims. If they believe that Prophet was a prophet and received revelation, they would have become Muslim. We give the, it's just like, for example, if we want to analyze a faith which you do not believe it, yeah, of course, we look for some explanation. However, it's very amazing that some Muslim scholars have taken the same explanation and the same analysis, and have mentioned them in their books. And this is very amazing. That means we have to reject all these traditions, and we have to say that these reporters like Saduq, like Mufid, like Tusi, like people before them, they meticulously made up all these traditions, which is very difficult, very unacademic to think in this way. It's very difficult to prove it. As I said, it's a matter of belief, that you have to believe in it. It's not an academic type of analysis. And another tradition from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, to the same effect. As I said, there are hundreds of traditions in this sort of prediction, not predictions, foretelling about what will happen in future about the 12th Imam. Initially, at the beginning of these lectures, if you remember, we talked about the 12 Amins or the 12 Khalifa, about which the Prophet talks. And they are in Bukhari, in Muslim, in all Sunni books, that there will be 12 Khalifa after me. Now, this knowledge that, okay, who is the 12th one? What will happen to the 12th one? Were quiet, understood, and understood by companions of the Prophet, and they had traditions compiled in that effect. The difference between the Shia and Sunni Hadith, I don't say this because I'm a Shia, but you can explore for yourself. The difference between the Shia and Sunni Hadith is that the Sunni Hadith talks about issues very succinctly, without deeper explanation. Because, of course, there were just quick references from the Prophet about them. And sometimes people even didn't ask the Prophet about these concepts. One example is the concept of Arsh, for example, or Kursi, which we have in the Quran. You just compare the traditions which have come from the Imams about what Arsh is, and the traditions in the Sunni books. Traditions in the Sunni books are just, we accept it, do not ask about it, it is just a throne, we don't know what is the quality, the explanation of it, and not more than this. And if they want to go into details in unreliable traditions, then of course the details will become somehow funny. Now, you go to the traditions of A'imma alayhim as-salam, you see there's deep knowledge there. These were the people who knew about these things. Certainly, Imam Malik was right to say, do not ask me how Allah is sitting on the throne. You know the story, someone asking that, Ar-Rahman ala al-Arsh istawa, kaifa istawa, how Allah is sitting on the throne. He said, we know that he's sitting on the throne, we don't know how, don't ask. It's better to ask. He's right, because he doesn't have knowledge about it. What should he say? He should say, I don't know, don't ask about it. But if you go to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, he explains to you, what is it? What's the meaning of him sitting on the throne? What is the meaning of the throne? How the throne is created? What is the relation of the throne with other parts of creation? Now, this, in that respect, you take it. Now, you come to traditions about these 12. Of course, these were the people who were members of these 12, certainly. And they knew who these 12 are, what's going to happen to them, who is the last one, what is the situation and destiny of the last of these 12. So you find the same difference in Sunni Hadith and in Shia Hadith. So here we would expect in Shia Hadith from A'imma alayhim as-salam a really detailed explanation of these things, and especially when it comes to the destiny of the 12th Imam, we have to get full information about it. And certainly, as we proceed, you will see that the abundance of information about the time just before his reappearance, what happens when he appears, what happens afterwards, all these information were there with the Imams, certainly. And they had them in different books, different, of course, inspirations that Allah had given them. Of course, there is knowledge. Maybe we have to have a full course about the different categories of the knowledge of the Imam. What was the source of their knowledge? They had not only one source of knowledge, many, many different sources of knowledge they had. Now here, both Khulaini and Nu'mani in his book Al-Ghayza, and Khulaini, of course, in Al-Kafi, they report from Imam Abi Ja'far alayhi salam, Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam, Abdullah ibn Ata Abdullah ibn Ata, I listen here, Abdullah ibn Rabah, sorry, this is a different man, Abdullah ibn Ata, the Arabic is right, says, I talked to Imam al-Baqir, you have huge following in Iraq, and by God, there's no virtue in your family, why then you do not rise? He told me, فَقَالَ يَا عَبْدُ اللَّهِ عَتَى قَدْ أَخَذَتَ تَفْرَشُ أُذُنَيْكَ لِلنَّوْحِ. He said, you pay attention to the dim-witted, the Shia with little knowledge. And of course, A'imma alayhimu salam always complained about these Shia with little knowledge. فَفَلَتُ أَهْلِ الْكُوفَ, the sort of cultural riffraff of Kufa, who accepted anything about the Imam, who attributed anything they held to the Imam without investigation, and they came up with very funny beliefs about Imam and all these things. And inshallah, we are not from those people. We have to be very careful. What we believe about the Imam should be correct belief, not something like what Imam usually at that time talks about, and no-key, stupid people who talk about our Imam the way they believe that we are the Imams. You pay attention to the dim-witted. By God, I'm not your man. Wallahi ma ana bisahibikum. That means that person who you think would rise with sword is not me. Qala qultu lahu, and A'im alayhi wasalam actually conveyed this to all the Ahlul Bayt, like Zayd ibn Ali, like Yahya ibn Zayd, like Banu Hassan, that you should not come out with, in the name of Mahdi. We discussed this before, of course. قَالَ قُلْتُ لَهُ فَمَنْ صَاحِبُنَا. I told him, who's our man then? Who's the man who would lead us? قَالَ أُنْظُرُ مَنْ أَمِيَ عَلَى النَّاسِ وَلَادَتُهُ فَذَاكَ صَاحِبُكُمْ. He said, look for someone whose birth is veiled from the people. He is your man. Now, this is a very clear indication. This is about 100 years before the birth of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, saying that his birth will be in confusion because of the secretive way that, well, the situation is as such. I mean, Imam Hassan al-Askari, why Imam Hassan al-Askari was put in a garrison, in a military barrack, to live there? Because they wanted to know what's happening, what's going to happen, who's the 12th, is this the 11th, who's the 12th, they wanted to know about it. Because everyone now had this idea of the 12th, who's the 12th? You know, Imam Hassan al-Askari was living in that garrison since he was 4 years old. And he could not come out of it, except when he wanted to report to the court. He had to report to the court twice a week. And he was under strong, strict surveillance. His wife was under strict surveillance, his house, himself, to know what's happening, is a child is going to be born or not. So here, 100 years before that, it is said that look for someone whose birth is veiled from the people. He is your man. None of us would be pointed at by fingers or talked about by tongues unless they die of sorrow or are killed. Now, this is very interesting. انظروا من عمي على الناس ولادته فذاك صاحبكم إنه ليس منا أحد يشار إليه بالأسبع ويمزغ بالألسن إلا مات غيظا أو رغب أنفه. You go around and say that Imam is Ja'far ibn Muhammad or Muhammad ibn Ali. You say and spread, you go and spread this, and you are killed. And this was the case with all the Imams, of course. They never said we are Imams to common public, certainly. That's why you see many Sunni scholars went to Imams' lessons, lectures, without knowing that they are Imams. They just wanted to benefit from their knowledge. And Imam never revealed, for example, in those big lectures on Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, many of the students didn't know that he is the Imam of the Shia. Only those very close disciples. As I said, our knowledge about Imam Ali is now much more than the knowledge of the contemporaries of Imam Ali Musala. And here Imam says, okay, you go and spread this. You have heard the story of Ali ibn Yaqin, for example, in the court of Harun al-Rashid, that he denied that he is a Shia, and denying that Musa al-Kadhim is an Imam. Of course, he was in prison most of his life on the doubt that the Shias believed that he was an Imam. Now suppose that there was a definite knowledge that he was the Imam. What would have happened? Well, of course, eventually he was martyred. But the point is that this secrecy was something we have not lived in that situation to know what was the atmosphere, what type the atmosphere was. Here Imam said, you go around, you point at us, he's the Imam. You, for example, with your friend, you go, you know, this is the Shia Imam. And then that friend is a spy and goes and report, and then people come. Then pressure would come on us, and so much pressure that we die of sorrow or we are killed. This is not going to happen for the 12th Imam, certainly. Because if he is like us, like one of us, he would die like one of us. So why Imam brings this here as a sort of reason for why he had a secret birth? Because you spread the news in a way that we get in trouble. Now, this is from Ahmad ibn Ishaq al-Ash'ari al-Qummi, who was one of the, reportedly, he met, of course he lived in Qum, he met Imam al-Askari a couple of times. It was very difficult to meet Imam al-Askari, because as I said, he was living in a military barrack. People who went there, the companions of the Imam, they should have found really, really very difficult ways to get access to his house, for example. Here Ahmad ibn Ishaq says, دَخَلْتُ عَلَىٰ أَبِي مُحَمَّدْ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ فَقَالَ لِي يَا أَحْمَدْ, what was your stance towards what the people were in doubt about it? Well, of course, again, the news was given to some companions, not to others. A faraway city like Qom, it doesn't matter if the news spreads. And the news had reached to the scholars in Qom that the Imam is born. But of course, no one knows what they were about. So Imam is asking, when you heard the news that my son is born, what was your stance? I said, my master, when the letter containing the news of our master's birth arrived, no man or woman or discerning child remained unless all believed the truth. Now, of course, this should have been a very strict circle. And this tells us a very interesting fact, that despite the strict secrecy, still the Imam had the means to spread the news to some scholars that the Imam is born. And this answers the very, very difficult question, that if this was so secret, how come no considerable scholar, Shia scholar? There were, of course, pretenders, there were people who were not scholars and they somehow claimed things for themselves, especially when they claimed to be naib of Imam, not, of course, claiming that Imam was not born. How come that all the scholars were convinced that the Imam was born and he was the Imam, and everyone were convinced about his nawab as well? Now, when we come to his nawab, if we get time, probably that's a side issue. It's very interesting that what a sort of network, underground network was there, that this news of, for example, who's the next Naib? Of course, this was again a secret news. Who's the next Naib? All the scholars agreed upon it. In Qom, in Khurasan, in Iraq, in Hijaz, there was no disagreement at all. It's very, very amazing. I think this needs investigation. This needs a real research. What sort of networking was there that the secret news were accepted scholars, like scholars in caliber of the father of Saduq, for example. They were the contemporaries in the minor occultation. All the scholars in his caliber, they had no disagreement on this issue. And this is very strange, how this news was spread. Now, here is one hint that a letter went to Qom. Ahmad ibn Ishaq was a very reliable person. He had the news. He spread the news to some, and he said everyone became happy. He said, did you not know that the earth would not be void of a hujja? Which, of course, the hadith is a bit broken. This part of the conversation is just stops here. The interesting is here what Ahmad ibn Ishaq said. Then Abu Muhammad, that's Imam Hassan al-Askari, instructed his mother to Hajj pilgrimage, to go to Hajj, in the year 259. Of course, this then doesn't mean that Ahmad ibn Ishaq was there, it's reporting the history, what happened. And informed his mother of what will happen to him in the year 260. So when he instructed his mother to go to Hajj, he told him that next year I'm going to die. He called As-Sahib alayhi salam to his presence and made his will and submitted to him the great name and the bequest and the weapon. Then the mother of Abu Muhammad left for Mecca with the Sahib. Now this is a very interesting hadith. Very, very interesting hadith. First of all, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was not all the time in Samarra. In 259, we know that he left for Mecca. He was not there anymore. We have traditions that he was present when Imam al-Askari was on his deathbed. So probably he had come to be present for the demise of his father. And again he went. I mean, he did not stay in Samarra. Samarra was not a safe place. It was an army barrack where they used to live. And that moment of death of Imam al-Askari, when he came, there was not time for making the will or something like that. So 1 year before that, according to this hadith, all the secrets of Imamah was transferred to Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam when he was 4 years old. Now, three things are mentioned here transferred to the Imam. Al-Ismul A'zam. This is bigger than what we can talk about, of course, Ismul A'zam. It's not a name, certainly, it's a knowledge which he conveyed or transferred to the heart of the of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So he gives him Ismul A'zam. Wal Mawarif. Mawarif, what are the Mawarif? The books which are with the Imam. Jeff and Jana and Sahifa and all these things. And some belongings of the Prophet, peace be on him. Especially one thing which is the sign of the Imamah, the weapon, the sword of the Prophet, which goes from one Imam to the other. Which usually the sword of every person used to go to the heir or wasi, someone who was in charge of the affairs of the deceased, like the greatest son or something. And this weapon of the Prophet came down to Amir al-Mu'mineen, and it should be now with the with Imam al-Mahdi. It's just like the tabut, the chest in Banu Israel, which contained the Torah. And we have in the Quran about Talut, إِنَّ آيَةَ مُلْكِهِ أَنْ يَأْتِيَكُمُ التَّابُوتِ فِيهِ سَكِينَةٌ مِّن رَبِّكُمْ. The sign of his kingdom over you, that he is appointed by God, the sign is that the tabut, the chest, will come to you, in which there is sakina and calmness from the Lord. The sign of Imam Mahdi is that the sword of the Prophet is with him, and with that sword is victory, of course. So he transferred all these to the Imam, and Abu Muhammad left for Mecca with the Sahib alayhi salam, a mother of Abu Muhammad, Nargis, or sorry, mother of Abu Muhammad, not mother of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, moved to Mecca with Imam alayhi salam. In fact, in those 5 years of the life of Imam al-Afkari, the whereabouts of the Imam was unknown. There are hints that at times he used to come to Samarra, but not all the time he was there. Now, even if we say he was there all the time, definitely 1 year before the demise of Imam al-Afkari, he moved from Samarra to Mecca. Other reports, however, imply that he was with his father at the moment of his death, as I mentioned, but that means it was a very quick sort of visit, just at the moment of the death of the Imam alayhi salam. Mawari, yes. That, the books, like Sahih Fajr from Jami'a, and some other belongings of the Prophet of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Now, after that, what happened? Where did the Imam live? Most of the traditions imply that Imam lives in Medina or nearby. And this Raghwa, again, the mountain which is close to Medina, which we discussed about, might be one place. In Al-Kafi, we have a reliable report from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, لا بد لصاحب هذا العام من غيبة ولا بد له في غيبته من أذلة ونئم المنزل طيبح وما بثلاثين من وحش. A very interesting hadith. Of course, very difficult to explain. Now, Kulayni in Al-Kafi and Tusi in Al-Ghaybah from Imam Al-Baqir and Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the incumbent of this affair, this is what I have translated as Sahibu Hada Al-Amr. This affair, of course, is the affair of the Imam, the Imam who rises, who is Qa'im, and of course Sahibu Hada Al-Amr, the one who is incumbent with this sort of duty. The incumbent of this affair would necessarily have disappearance, Ghaybah. And there will be necessarily loneliness in his disappearance. Of course, none of us would really wish to be in place of Imam al-Mahdi, living alone. It's very difficult. Living alone is very difficult. Maybe good for a couple of years, but not for 1400, 1200 years, and God knows how long is that going. But of course, he's not completely alone, but a few people around him maybe. However, he loses them all the time, isn't it? They don't have the long time, the long life as he has. It's very difficult. I mean, you just live to see other people, your dear ones die and die and die one after another, and especially you don't have that sort of huge connection with people. So here Imam says, لا بد في غيبته من غزلها. He should have loneliness. Medina is a good place of residence, so he's implying that he lives in Medina. وَلَئِ مَا الْمَنْزِلْ طَيِّبَةً. Because it's beside the tomb of the Prophet. Maybe Imam alayhi salam visits the Prophet's shrine every night. who knows. And there is no fear among 30 people. Now, these 30 people, of course, is very puzzling. وَمَا بِثَلَاثِنَ مِنْ بَحْشَ Of course, he is lonely, but with 30 people, we don't regard it as loneliness. Are the 30 people around Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam? Does he have 30 companions around him all the time? Of course, as I said, these are not going to have the same lifespan as Imam al-Mahdi has, so they have to replace one another. And therefore, there is this possibility that those who really will get close to in their spiritual life, close to the type of status of Imam alayhi salam, they are chosen to serve Imam. However, they are chosen to serve, they are not allowed to say anything about this, even if they are in contact. So anyone claiming that, just tell them you are a liar. Because that anyone coming to that status certainly would never reveal anything about it. There is another hadith which explains this a little bit. This again in Al-Kafi. Now the 30 people referred to here may be those alluded to in the following hadith from Imam al-Sadiq. Now I've chosen these traditions mainly from Al-Kafi and Ghaybah because these are reliable sources. There are other traditions, of course, which we cannot rely upon. لَلْقَائِمْ غَيْبَتَانْ For the Qa'im there are two Ghaybahs, there are two occultations. إحداهما قصيرة والأخرى طويلة. There will be two occultations for the Qa'im. One will be short and the other will be long. In the first occultation, no one knows his whereabouts except the elite of his Shia. Okay, we understand the elite of his Shia. In the minor occultation, like his Nawab, some others who were led to the Imam by the Nawab, very, very elite among the Shia. In the other one, no one knows of his place except the elite of his clients. Now, his clients or mawali, khassatu mawali, are probably those who attend to his affairs, who take errands from him, do things on his order, on his behest. These may be these 30 people who do things on his behalf. And who knows who these people are, of course. It's quite secret. Apparently, his clients are those who attend to his needs. As in the following hadith from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, لا يطلع على موضعه أحد من ولي ولا غيره إلا المولى الذي يلي أمره. No one will be aware of his place, nor a friend, nor any other person. No matter how close you become to Imam in your heart, you wouldn't know where he is. Except the client who attends to his needs. These are the people. Of course, we should not expect that he lives utterly alone, doing everything himself. That would be really difficult, of course. And whether he has family or not, that's an issue we cannot say. So there are people who, there are clients who attend to his needs, and also sometimes he might want to do things in this world, and not all of them is done by himself, by some of his clients, taking messages sometimes, we don't know. Probably. Okay, so it's a life of loneliness, of course, and it is it's not something easy for the Imam alayhi salam as well. Of course, he is all the time connected to the Lord and absorbed in the love of God. However, he is human being. I mean, like the Prophet who was a human being. He had other needs than just all the time being absorbed in love of God and connection to God as a man he had. And certainly Imam alayhi salam had. So, something like, can we say something like Khidr alayhi salam? Khidr. We have many traditions that Khidr is alive and has a long life until the end of this world. So maybe that would somehow alleviate the situation, knowing that there is another person like him in this world, living that lonely type of life. It is also reported from Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq, إِنَّ لِصَاحِبَ هَذَا الْأَمْرِ بَيْتًا يُقَالُ لَهُ بَيْتُ الْحَمْدِ فِيهَ سِرَاجٌ يَظْهَرُ مُنْذُ يَوْمَ وُلِدَ إِلَى يَوْمَ يَقُومُ بِالسَّيْفِ. For the incumbent of this affair, there is a house called the House of Praise, Baytul Hamd. A light burns in it from the day he was born to the day that he will rise with the sword. Now, whether we have to take this metaphorically or literally, both would make sense. Of course, where he lives is really, really Baytul Hamd, isn't it? Who can praise God better than him? So he lives in Baytul Hamd, and it mentions that he has a house. So he just does not wander about. He has a house, and the house is most probably somewhere in Medina. Ni'ma Manzil Tayba. Medina is a good place of residence for him. And that house is called Baytul Hamd. And maybe you have passed by the house, who knows? But we do not realize, certainly, of course, what that house is. And in it, there is a light which burns. And this, as I said, this we can take metaphorically or literally. It's, whatever it may mean. Now, hadith from Zurara, again in Ghaybat al-Nu'mani, سمعت أبا عبد الله عليه السلام يقول إن للقائم غيبتين يرجع في إحداهما. Imam al-Sadiq said, for the Qa'im there will be two occultations, in one of which he returns. In terms, it means that he disappears, but he is in contact with his Nawab, he meets his Nawab, talks to them, they take messages from him. In the other, his whereabouts is unknown. You might say that now even he is in contact with some people, as we have 30 people, but these are not his Nawab. They are not allowed to say anything. They are not allowed to take message to anyone on behalf of Imam, for example. As soon as they say we are in connection with the Imam, the connection is lost. Of course, they would never say that. In one of which he returns, in the other his whereabouts is unknown. He would attend the Hajj and see the people, why they do not see him. But this is of course very well known. Yes.
Does this mean that people cannot see him or cannot recognize
him? Well, here it says they do not see him. I don't know if we see him and do not recognize him, that is possible as well. But the hadith here, it says that they do not see him. He sees the people, they do not see him. It might mean they do not recognize him. That's possible. Now, Ubayd ibn Zurara, this is some of the above reported, قال سمعت أبو عبد الله الحسن يقول يفقد الناس إمامهم يشهد الموسم فيراهم ولا يرونه. The people will lose their Imam. He attends the Mawsim, that's the Hajj, and would see them, but they don't see him. Now, does he perform Hajj everywhere? Still, maybe. Most probably, if he doesn't have any other thing to do on the time of Hajj. Maybe he has. We don't know. We have some weak tradition that I didn't bring them here because I do not believe that might be correct in Kashf al-Ghumma and others, that the year that he does not perform Hajj, the Hajj of people is not accepted. Right. That might mean what? That might mean that maybe many sinners would go to Hajj and that all the people who go to Hajj are sinners, so he doesn't go in that year. And therefore the Hajj is not accepted. Otherwise, what's the sin of the people who go there for the with the hope of forgiveness, and the Hajj is not accepted because the Imam has not attended Hajj. So that's a weak thing. I don't want to I don't want to confuse you with and myself with that tradition. However, we don't know whether he attends every year. Some years he doesn't come because of some other business that he might have. Not, of course, business in terms of worldly business. Hassan Ali ibn Khazal, the famous, of course, Fatahi Rawi, that we accept all his traditions, Hassan Ali ibn Khazal. قال سمعت أبا الحسن علي بن موسى الرضا عليه السلام يقول إن الخضر عليه السلام لا يحضر الموسم كل سنة. Now here this كل سنة is here. حسن علي بن موسى الرضا reports from Imam الرضا عليه السلام that خضر attends Hajj every year and performs all the manasik. He performs the stay in Arafah and says Amin on the prayer of the believers. So you pray something and Khair says, Amin, Ya Allah, please respond, accept what he says. And Allah will soothe the loneliness and the apprehension about Qa'im through his company. So, when Imam, according to this tradition, this is from Kamaluddin again of Saduq, according to this tradition, when Imam alayhi salam goes to perform Hajj, he has one roommate. And that's Khadr. They perform the manasik together. And so he's not very lonely there. And you shouldn't think that his clients, those who attend his home, are always with him. He is much higher in status than those people, so he cannot all the time have the company of these people. But what is important is that here in Hajj, the Imam alayhi salam, Imam Reza alayhi salam says that he is not alone in Hajj. He is with Khadr performing Hajj together. And another tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, لَابُدَّ لِلْغُلَامِ مِنْ غَيْبَةٍ فَقِيلَ لَهُ وَلِمَا يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ قَالَ يَخَافُ الْقَاتِلَ. There will be no escape for the boy from occultation. Boy, why? Because when he went to occultation, he was a boy. He was only 5 years old, okay? And it's a sort of weird knowledge, isn't it? Of course, as if they see what's happening there. It's not a reported knowledge to the Imam. It's just as if they see. That's why he calls him boy, the boy. The boy would certainly go to occultation. And when he was asked why, he replied, because he fears to be murdered. يَخَافُ الْقَتْلَ. And this is, of course, the same thing as what we had before, that because he wants, when he comes, he has no allegiance with anyone. Because if he has allegiance, he's not killed. So he doesn't want to have allegiance with anyone. So he shouldn't have taken sides with anyone. However, these are just partial answers to the question. The main philosophy behind it is unknown, as we see in the following hadith. Why he has gone to occultation, we say many different reasons, the situation, he gets killed like other a'imma. Why should, of course, he's the last of the 12, as the Prophet had said, so why should he be killed? However, the reason, the real reason and philosophy behind this ghaiba is unknown to us. Again from Kamaluddin of Saduq, from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the incumbent of this affair will have a disappearance from which there is no escape, in which every perverse will doubt, يَرْتَابُ فِيهَا كُلُّ مُبْطِلٍ. Anyone who say I'm a Shia, I'm a Muslim, but they are perverse people in their heart, they will doubt about it. I asked why may I be ransomed to Al-Tufadak? He said, for a reason that we are not allowed to disclose for you. So he doesn't say we don't know, we know why he goes to occultation, but we are not allowed to disclose for you. I said, so So what is the wisdom behind his disappearance? He said the wisdom behind it would not be revealed unless after he reappears. In the same way that the wisdom behind the acts of Khidr, damaging the ship, killing the young boy and erecting the wall, as you know the story in Surah Al-Kahf, was not revealed to Musa until the time of their departure. He said, do not ask me until I start to tell you. And he did not tell and tell and tell, unless Musa lost patience. And just at that point of departure, he said, okay, I'll tell you why. Now here, Imam al-Sadr said, you cannot. What? It means that no matter how it's explained to you, it doesn't make sense. Until he comes, it's just like what happens on the Day of Judgment. Many things which were told to us about the Day of Judgment don't make sense to us. Until we go and see, inshallah, soon, and see what's happening there. And here he says, until he comes, you never can comprehend what the reason behind the occultation. This issue is an issue from God, and it seeks us from the seekers of God. إِنَّ هَذَا الْأَمْرُ أَمْرٌ مِّنْ أَمْرِ اللَّهِ تَعَالَى وَسِرٌّ مِّنْ سِرِّ اللَّهِ. Okay. These four last slides are the translation of this hadith Lawh Fatima that I mentioned last week, but it was only in Arabic, so you can have a look at that as well. Any questions? Alaykum assalam to both of you.
If the person is not sure he has a family, then why is he confused about Saleh?
Well, these kunyas, well, we said we don't know whether he has a family or not. But these kunyas are sometimes given to people even when they are born, for example, to men even when they are born. Therefore, someone who is really connected to something, like for example, Abu Turab for Amir al-Mu'mineen, because he was on the dust. And he liked that very much. To somehow all the time thinking that he is created from the dust. And because of course this is the Salih man on the earth, he is called Abu Salih probably. But anyhow, as I said, we don't know really about his family. And even if he has family, all the time he has to lose them, isn't it? It's because he outlives all his children, grandsons and these things. It will be very difficult. And then of course, these families would grow and grow. I mean, 1400 years. And then, walking in London or Paris or Tehran, you should see children of Imam, descendants of the Imam, knowing that they are from Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So, most probably, like Khidr, he doesn't have family. Yeah.
When the tradition talk about the loneliness, is it talking about a physical loneliness, or could it be that he is amongst the people living with the people who not recognize him, and the loneliness is in the fact that he cannot reveal who he is threatening to be?
Yeah, that's loneliness. I mean, suppose just someone comes and sits here, he cannot tell you who he is, you cannot talk to him, he cannot talk to you. That's loneliness. No, physical, not in the sense that he always lives alone, but in the sense that he cannot make contact with anyone.
You say that he became the sword of the Islam or the Prophet's death, and he seems to be more even in this day that nuclear weapons. And as time is advancing, maybe there'll be other weapons. How does that correlate with creation? How does he affect the non-believers or
No, that sword is a sign. It doesn't mean that he is going to fight with that sword. That sword is a sign that he is the heir of the Prophet, and he has that inheritance from the Prophet. Certainly he's not going to fight with that sword nowadays. How is he going to fight? And I mean, today we have nuclear bombs, which hopefully, inshallah, would be destroyed through a sort of universal consensus about it. But who knows when he comes, what type of weapons we have. It's not possible for us to imagine. So that sword, the importance of that sword is that he can show it to people and say, this is the sword of the Prophet. I am the heir of the Prophet. That's the importance. It's just a sort of symbolic sign. Yeah.
You mentioned some of the academic doubts that have been shed on the presence of the Twelfth Imam, and you mentioned the work of Shaykh and Golder in sort of just trying to, in a sense, discredit the work of Hadith in its totality. The doubts expressed by Shia scholars, sort of contemporary and in the past, but you mentioned there were very few such scholars who had raised such doubts, obviously. But were their doubts based on similar grounds, sort of dismissing Hadith in general, or was it the actual specific content of the Hadith?
They have actually gone down the path of historical analysis of events which it has reached them, rather than paying any attention to Hadith. They have tried to make a sort of independent judgment without looking at the Hadith, which is not right, certainly. And in that sense, that means they have completely dismissed the Hadith. And that means that they did not regard the Hadith to be something noticeable at all. So that's a wrong, I think it's an utterly wrong method for analyzing these issues.
You said that people who met Imam cannot say that they met Imam. You've got so many stories about people who met Imam. So do you believe the story, or is it because they've died and then you find out about them? And another thing about the client, could there be people that work for the Imam but they don't know his Imam?
They don't know he's the Imam?
Yes.
No.
And indirectly?
No. What? Inshallah, all of us are working for the Imam. And we don't know we are working. But those clients who attend to his needs and whatever he wants from the servant, they know that he's the Imam. Now, these stories about people meeting the Imam, if you look at all of them, you see, they say, we saw someone coming, telling something, and then he disappeared. And then we said, oh, he was the Imam. Why didn't we ask him such and such questions? And it all gives this doubt that, did they really visit the Imam? Or one of his clients? Or whatever? And some scholars who somehow make compromise between these stories and those firm traditions who say that whoever claims that has met him is a liar, they have said, okay, we do not reject these stories because these stories come from pious people. But then the point is that One explanation is that in all these situations, they realized he was Imam after they lost him, after he disappeared. And they say, okay, one explanation might be that you cannot meet the Imam knowing that he is the Imam. You can meet him and afterwards you realize that he was the Imam. But most of these stories are just guessing, isn't it? They guess that he was the Imam because he just came out of nowhere. And then he did something very extraordinary and he went. Maybe he's cursed. Who knows? So, yeah.
Yashin, just connecting to the question before regarding historical analysis and Hadith. Does this mean that the Shia scholars who have gone down the route of historical analysis, that they somehow ignore the Hadith But on the other side, where we have the non-Muslims, that they ignore the hadith because hadith is not part of historical analysis?
Well, they do not accept this sort of transmission of knowledge at all. So they say, let us make an independent judgment about this, how these ideas came about. We had a teacher who wanted to teach Shi'ism in the college, and when we discussed about things, he said, yes, of course, the idea of Hujja, the idea of Mahdi, it just came about gradually as the Shi'as found out, for example, they need a Hujja, as they found out they need an Imam after the occultation. I mean, they have somehow lent their ears completely to this type of analysis. Of course, even among non-Muslim scholars, this type of analysis is now criticized greatly, that this is not a correct way to, and this is not independent judgment, you have to look at what you have. Many Western scholars have criticized immensely, I mean, they have criticized Shah, have criticized others who have gone down that path. And I think this belongs to the to 50s and 60s. And even the Shia scholars who have talked about this are somehow very outdated now. This is not something which any scholar could accept, this type of analysis.
It's just because we can't do
You have mentioned in the note the actual event which took place on the birth of the Imam on the actual 15th night. Are those all the reports reliable?
Well, you hear them in Majalis. Why should I mention them? I try to bring things which usually are not said. Otherwise, I mean about the birth, I mean when he came, praise, and all these things. We have these traditions, and you have heard them several times. So, I don't want to bore you with repetition. If you want, I can bring them.
Just think
of
any
language.
Yeah.
Okay. Is that the last question? Yeah.
Thank you very much for the mention. Just before I go back to the same question, it's very interesting, regarding the hadith. Because my understanding that accepting hadith is not an article of faith, and it doesn't have to have faith, it's necessarily accept historical evidence, which is one has to accept it from an old tradition and it was recorded at various times. So, I would, based on my very limited knowledge, agree with the fact that, to ignore that leads to a false analysis. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we do know that there are very highly academic people, like Dr. Suri, for example, who might have a view which we may not agree with. So, how does he face the arguments? I'm sure it's an intellectual.
The point about hadith is that Goldziher, at the beginning of the, towards the end of the 20th century, 19th century, and then Schacht afterwards, they established a method of analysis in Islamic studies, which was disregarding, in a sense, they had suspicion about every Muslim scholar. That was the basis for it. That they said, Imam Malik, Abu Hanifa, Bukhari, Muslim, whoever. What they say is that they were not people of honor. They lied, they fabricated things. All these traditions were made up after the life of the Prophet. And they, of course, based the argument on very shaky sort of basis. But they built a sort of theory which became very common and widely accepted among scholars at the beginning of the 20th century onwards to the to 1950s, 60s, even 70s. It was very widespread. And the reason for the rejection of it is, as you said, this. You cannot say that all these people were liars. You cannot say all these people
were just trying to compete with each other, fabricating traditions and saying that this tradition supports outside and they fabricate another tradition supporting outside. It's not possible. The problem is that this became the standard method in study of Islam in the West. And those scholars, from Muslim scholars and Shia scholars, who at that time came to study Islam in Western universities, they either willingly or unwillingly were somehow trapped in this type of methodology, which was the only methodology, so to speak. And therefore they, the Shia scholars who wanted to analyze, especially in the Shia history, like, I don't want to mention names, but they had to, or they thought that this is the only scholarly way of analysis, and they used the methods. Now, using the method means, of course, this is something that people usually are not aware of, that means that you are accusing every scholar, every Shia scholar, every Muslim scholar of that truth, that they were liars, they fabricated things, you just discard history and historical facts without any reasoning, without any plausible cause. And as I said, now of course the method is to a great extent obsolete, and even in the Western academia they do not use the method anymore. And they have criticized very immensely that the method of Shah, and I don't think they are using it anymore. And I think nowadays even Shia scholars in academia, they, if they want to do the research, they would use another method rather than that historical analysis. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Allahumma sallam.